You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA. You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino. Wow, you came in hot there.
Well, I was thinking about the Seahawks game and not about the Seattle Storm game. It's a weekend recap, as there was so much going on in Seattle sports. This is not going to be the full podcast. It's coming later in the week, along with our previews of the Apple Cup, which Washington State, not part of this weekend recap, but ooh, tough. As well as the Seahawks week 3 matchup against the New Orleans Saints. And we'll see what we're talking about with Seattle Storm at that point, but may not be game 3 of their series against the Las Vegas Aces. But let's start at the top quickly. I'm coming to you from Seattle, Washington, home of your first place.
There it is.
Seattle Mariners, the latest in the season. They have been in first place alone in the AL West since 2001.
That is incredible. I'm coming to you from Washington, home of, this time, the Seattle Seahawks.
I guess they can't be in first place. No, San Francisco won. There was a second there with the Saints. It was like, oh, maybe.
I'm pretty sure they're in last place in the NFC West. I think everybody else is undefeated.
Yeah, you're right. It's a good point. Wow, this division's good.
Have you seen the schedule?
They flipped the bench?
No, kind of.
We thought it was supposed to be one of the easiest schedules in the NFL. I don't know if the NFC South is disproving that, but...
No. What I'm saying is these teams have not played. They ain't play nobody ball right now with these teams.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yes, that is undoubtedly accurate. Yes.
There were victories yesterday over the Saints and the Titans and the Panthers. Those were the three other teams
until next week, when the Saints will be an unstoppable juggernaut, depending on the results of the Seahawks game. Anyways. The Seahawks are not atop the NFC West, but
they're not last in the NFC West in a point differential. That would be the San Francisco 49ers.
Yeah. The Seahawks go on the road. As is their want, at 10 a.m. Pacific time, take down an Eastern time zone opponent in the Pittsburgh Steelers, 31-17. Do you have any message to the quarterback of the Pittsburgh Steelers?
I feel like I should need to save that just straight from the top.
Okay.
We have to build up to it. I don't even know if I was going to get there, to be honest, because he's not even relevant enough to care.
Oh, he is relevant enough that the Seahawks are now the first team to have beaten Aaron Rodgers at the quarterback of the Packers, obviously many times.
Yes.
Not that many times, but several times.
I remember one notable time, actually.
Crucial time.
That's the only time that really matters to me.
It was also the season opener against the Packers. That was a pretty notable one. Fail Mary, notable one. There were some good ones. Not any of them in Lambeau Field. Beat him as quarterback of the New York Jets last year. Mike McDonald stifling Aaron Rodgers. And now I've beat him as quarterback of the Pittsburgh Steelers. His only loss is quarterback of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Nobody else can say that.
100% of the teams who have beaten Aaron Rodgers as quarterback of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Do you know what the name of the former Heinz Field is now?
No, because I referred it to Heinz Field when we were casually conversing before the pod on the phone.
It is called Acrisure Stadium, and teams from Seattle, Washington are dominant in events sponsored by Acrisure or at stadiums named Acrisure, undefeated in those stadiums, cannot be stopped.
And Acrisure hates to see a Seattle team come in. That is for sure the case. Wow. I was completely unaware. But a game that for a while looked like it was going to be a very frustrating performance for the Seahawks, who completely dominated the first half of this one, but the couple of Sam Darnold interceptions, Pittsburgh getting some timely plays, leads this one 14-7 at halftime. Seahawks tie it in the third quarter, go ahead with a field goal, And then one of the strangest plays, undoubtedly, in Seahawks history, perhaps therefore one of the most Seahawksy plays in Seahawks history, the ensuing kickoff after the field goal bounces into the end zone. Debatable whether it was actually touched by my guy Caleb Johnson, who may not be lasting much longer on my fantasy roster at this rate.
He had one carry for 1 yard.
Like... it wasn't great. And George Halani hustles down.
Halani on the spot.
Recovers it in the end zone for the touchdown to give the Seahawks a 10-point lead. Steelers do come back, kick a field goal, get it to a one-score game. And then Ken Walker III closes this one out with the touchdown on third and goal from, I believe, the 19. It might have been the 20, though. It was a long ways out.
Finishing blow from Ken Walker. I love that you narrated that as if somebody who is like listening to this podcast was unaware of this information.
You know, it was just like a reminder of what happened. A in little case recap it all ran together for you.
Of what happened yesterday.
Well, the line judge for this game, according to the ESPN box score that I'm looking at, was Mark Stewart. Do you think it was the Mark Stewart from the Discord?
Has to be.
Yeah.
That's why the team won. Okay, so I want to walk you through. To me, the most important drive of the game was not... it wasn't the last drive. It wasn't the touchdown drive coming out of the half, or after the stop out of the half. It wasn't the picking up the touchdown, right, for Halani. It was the first drive of the game.
Okay. The first time the Seahawks have scored a touchdown on their opening drive since Drew Lock threw a touchdown to DK Metcalf, I believe, was the last time in the 2023 season.
Incredible.
You'll note that,
that
it's now 2025, which is much larger than 2023.
So they go, first play of the game, 1 yard run, Ken Walker, right? And I am just like, my level of anger is like, I am fuming at this point, even after the first play of the game. Second play of the game, short pass to Cooper Kupp, 3 yards. And I'm like, I loathe this football team, right? I'm back in that place that I was when we were on the podcast last week, last Wednesday or whatever.
You are airing some grievances.
15-yard pass to Jackson Smith and Jigba. 13-yard run. I'm like, okay, this is something. Followed up with 0-yard run. 0-yard run again. Both one for Ken Walker, one for Zach Charbonnet, right? The tandem both accounts for 0 yards. 12-yard pass to JSN. And I'm like, in this moment, I mean, you saw my chats. I'm like, the entire plan for the Seahawks offense is just we run up the gut for no yards and then pray that JSN bails us out of it. Which was kind of the plan at that point in that drive. And
honestly,
then,
there are worse plans than the JSN part of it.
Look, they could have thrown those passes to somebody else for those yards. Like they did, could have not.
They did subsequently throw some passes to someone else. We'll talk about it.
After that, play action pass, 21 yards to a wide open Torrey Horton. And I'm like, people, we are so fucking back. This is what the good offense looks like right now. The run, 0 yard runs up the gut. I don't know about that exactly, but the play action pass on that touchdown, and it's like, voila. It happened one time last week, and it happened one time in the first drive of the game, and it was to a wide open Torrey Horton.
And they kept using it. You know, they didn't get a lot of joy out of it during the first half necessarily, but they were running the good offense. You know, we're hard done by the Jason Myers missed field goal after they did go for it on fourth down. I mean, that was a bit of a storyline in this game too, was the fourth down decisions. Seahawks had, I believe, three situations where they were fourth and one. They were all fourth and ones, right? Went for
two
of them. Converted one on an A.J. Barner push, as Jalen Milroe was not active for this game. He was the designated third quarterback, so only could come in.
I mean, Barner ran it last week, though. That's what I'm saying. It's like, this is an A.J. Barner play more than it is a Jalen Milroe play.
It's a both. We'll see. Then after picking up 13 yards on third and 14, I believe it was, don't go for it right around midfield. A decision that I was probably more okay with than the Ben Baldwin model was, and most other observers. And then go for it.
I like the idea that the Ben Baldwin model has like feelings.
It expressed its feelings. It was a strong go. And then a third time they go for it, and Sam Darnold is intercepted.
Well, he was intercepted earlier in the game because I felt like they came back, right? Steelers drive down, score those 3 points. Very first play of the next series. Bam, play action again. Darnold throws a pick on the play. But I was like, the fact that they are throwing on first down, this is how offense needs to work in this situation. You don't run like when they're expecting you to run. That's basically the advantage you have. We've talked about this a ton as an NFL offense is you get to choose what you do. The defense has to react to what you're doing. You also get to fake doing one of those things and then do the other thing. So it's not even necessarily about running versus passing overall. It's about not letting the defense know what your plan is and keeping them on their toes overall. So they go play action. He throws the pick on the play. It was like there was a window there. And then they come back after that. Pick happens. I'm like, okay, that's fine. They do run it. Second play, 17 yards. Boom, Cooper Kupp right there. Third play of the series. They go tight, right? Everybody's at the line. And I'm like, if they run this ball up the gut, I'm going to be so angry at Clint Kubiak. No, play action. Sam Darnold fakes out, rolls out of the pocket, hits Elijah Royal. That's what you have to do in those situations, right? Because even the next time you're trying to do it, the amount that the defense is basically like they're putting it on tape that they're going to run this type of stuff from those situations. All of a sudden, the running is going to work better out of them. I felt like the way that they schemed that entire front half of the game was so much better than it had been the previous week. I don't know why they spent an entire offseason and landed at the offense they had in week one, but by week two, it was basically like, okay, Clint Kubiak, Mike McDonald have at least figured out this is generally what we want the offense to look like. And the ratios were much better after that as well. The run game didn't work. You can't necessarily like fault them for the, you could fault the players for some of the carries that didn't go anywhere for Charbonnet and the carries that did well for Ken Walker. But I felt like scheme-wise, process-wise, the offense was so much closer to what it should be with this particular offense.
And this is what we expected it to look like, you know, coming out of preseason after all the discussion in the offseason. And I will maybe never know what went wrong in week one.
I think they thought their shit didn't stink. That is what I will say. I think they had a preseason, and I think they saw that drive against the Chiefs where they marched the ball downfield and scored a touchdown basically without passing, and they were like, wow, it's going to be easy for us. I think they were just like, fuck, we're good. They thought that they could just run the ball. They felt like they could impose their will. They felt like they could go into a game, just run it down teams' throats. And after that didn't happen for one game, the fact that they were able to come back a week later and be like, okay, we actually need to run this offense, and we're able to pivot that quickly, it gives me much more faith in Clint Kubiak and Mike McDonald that they were able to pivot and not just be like, this is what we're going to do. There was a Jeff Albert quote on the Sunday Night Football. I don't know if you heard this, defensive coordinator of the Falcons, where he was like, I was stubborn when I was with the Jets. And he was like, I wasn't able to adjust to the way that we needed to play football. He was like, I felt like I had a plan and we had to stick to that. And I realized now you have to adjust for the talent that you have, the situation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, yeah. And that is clearly what they did in this game.
I mean, it was what I was expecting to see this weekend. It was unquestionably what I was hoping to see this weekend. So all of that was very good. I mean, I would say the one caveat here, like, it was good from a process standpoint. It's possible the Pittsburgh defense is just very bad. Because fun fact, that Jets offense under Tanner Engstrand, you were so excited about in week one, not so hot in week two. Did not translate the same way. A lot going on there. Small sample size still. But the Steelers might be very bad defensively, particularly against the run. But the other element of it that you didn't bring up is the Seahawks in this game were a reminder that the way you run is not by committing to the run. The way you run is by passing to run, not run to pass, pass to run. And that's what, you know, opened things up in the fourth quarter for Ken Walker III, which is when he did the majority of his damage late in this game in getting the Seahawks the lead and then sealing the game. And that's what you want to see. So, it, you know, obviously it was a far from a perfect game from Sam Darnold, but who I do think it's going to be an interesting watch, because Sam Darnold, it does seem just at times when he's under pressure, is just going to panic and bad things are going to happen. But if you can put Sam Darnold in the kind of advantageous situations that you're talking about by passing on early downs, using play action, I mean, Sam Darnold averaged 9 yards per attempt in this game. And the other piece of it that we haven't talked about is Cooper Kupp. I can't say I wasn't familiar with your game, but I do owe you an apology.
You want to know what Tyler Lockett did yesterday?
I'm confident it was not very much.
2 catches for 9 yards. It was a Tyler Lockett-like performance. I also wanted to point out the amount
of... It's not a Tyler Lockett-like performance.
It's a current Tyler Lockett-like performance. He just should have retired. But, like, keep getting the checks. Okay. A Cooper Kupp, first off, PFF grades, phenomenal in the run game. And that is
not
part
surprising.
Of what we're talking about here. Because Ken Walker likes to get outside. And some of those plays that are on the edge, Cooper Kupp is helping him out with that. Overall, let me see where he was team-wise. Third on the team on the offense in PFF grade today, ahead of JSN. So it was Ken Walker was number one, obviously. Best game of his career, probably. Number two, do you know who it was?
Gray Zabel?
Sam Darnold!
Oh,
Gray Zabel
okay.
was like last on the offense.
Wait, really?
Yeah, maybe the people who are isolating the single Gray Zabel play are not remembering some of the Zach Charbonnet 9 carries for 10 yards. But Charbonnet and Gray Zabel were the worst at PFF offensively. Number two was Sam Darnold. Number three was Cooper Kupp. And I say to the Sam Darnold haters out there, retire, bitch? I don't know. But I am telling you right now, I have been on Sam Darnold from the moment that the Seahawks signed him. And Grant, I will still be there. Even if he fails, I will say that the process was good. But right now, we are up on Sam Darnold. This was an excellent game that he had.
He did have a 47 QBR because of the interceptions.
Whatever QBR. Like, there are sometimes that situations happen badly. Like, the first pick, I was fine with. The second one, it got tipped. He was trying to get it over Cam Hayward. I wasn't watching that play when it happened live. He was trying to get it over Cam Hayward, and it took a favorable bounce for the Steelers. Shit happens. Aaron Rodgers threw 2 interceptions. He doesn't do that. Sam Darnold played really, really good.
I think actually Aaron Rodgers does do that. Certainly against the Seattle Seahawks, he
doesn't throw a lot of picks. Sam Darnold played
one last year, but
good in this game. And Sam Darnold put the ball where it needed to be, put the ball in the hands for his receivers where it needed to be. He ran the play action really well. He rolled out really well in that Arroyo play that I was talking about. Sam Darnold played a great game.
The escapability on the big throw downfield.
Oh, I mean, that was
that was to Kupp.
His best play of his career, basically, as a Seahawk. It was AJ Barner, I thought.
Okay. I would definitely say it's his best Seahawks play. I don't know if I want to speak to it compared
best play,
to his entire Vikings
his best season. Seahawks play. I mean, they come out of this with yards per, like, 8 yards per pass in this game. I mean, he played the story out of the game was Ken Walker, and it should be because he played a great game. The actual story overall was Sam Darnold. And I think that's, to me, what is pretty exciting about it is Ken Walker isn't going to do that every week. Like, we just know for Ken Walker might have a good season, but his chances of being at, like, what was it?
8.
13 carries for 105 yards. Like
8 yards per carry.
That's just not going to happen again. We know that. But it's
probably
going to
happen again. It just won't happen every week.
Yes, and that's not something that they can count on. But the pass game is something that they can do consistently.
And to me, the story of the game is the diversity in the Seahawks pass game after it was so JSN-centric. And look, JSN's really good. He's a number one receiver, no question about it. He's a guy who can do everything on offense. He's not, you know, a slot guy. He's not a screen guy. He's a guy who is a complete receiver. And 8 catches and 10 targets for 103 yards in this one. But Cooper Kupp, 7 catches and 9 targets for 90 yards. And then they get the other guys involved. 2 catches apiece for Horton, Arroyo, and A.J. Barner. And all of those, you know, every
huge
single
plays,
receiver.
Huge plays for Arroyo and Barner. Like the one that you mentioned and the one that I mentioned for Arroyo. Like, those are big plays.
In terms of yards per catch, every single receiver over 12.9 yards per reception. Like, these are chunk plays.
They open it up a little bit for Sam, too. And I felt like there was maybe one or two JSN plays where they were trying to get him stuff on short screens and things. Or it's like, fine, do that occasionally. But, like, this is what Sam Darnold does. You don't have Sam Darnold and have him dink and dunk, right? That's not who he is as a quarterback. So I don't know. I thought they schemed up a great game. And they get the lucky touchdown. But, like, they just kind of kicked the Steelers' ass here.
I mean, yes, in terms of yards per play, they completely dominated this game, 6.2 to 4.5. Like, if this game had been close, that would have been the flukier outcome, more so than them winning by two touchdowns. And that's where we haven't talked about the defense at all, but the defense was very good. Byron Murphy the second, breakout second season for him. That's very exciting. Rick Woolen bouncing back from his dismal game one and an early penalty in this one, and had to come out of the game due to a contact issue, but kind of made it seem like maybe he had been benched based on the discussion throughout the week. But without Devin Witherspoon, this Seahawks defense delivered a really terrific performance, and they made Aaron Rodgers look like you should make Aaron Rodgers at this stage of his career.
I mean, they had a 267 total yards, and 65 of those came on that one play to Jaylen Warren. So, obviously, like, Reek gets a lot of credit for the chase down tackle on that play that ended up leading to the interception, the Darion Kendrick interception after that. Reek's PFF grade was still terrible, basically worst on the defense. Josh Jobe has taken this job.
I don't know if he's taken the job, because there's two cornerbacks out there on most plays. Josh Jobe, though,
the better cornerback right now than Reek Woolen. And what Josh Jobe did against DK Metcalf in this game, it went to show, it was kind of like John Schneider must have been giddy after this performance.
Oh, it's very much the opposite of another Seattle sports game later in the day that we'll get to.
He should be, right? He traded away DK Metcalf for a pick. They didn't have to pay DK Metcalf. And DK Metcalf wasn't a factor in the game at all, basically, because Josh Jobe, who was undrafted, is that right?
I don't think he was drafted, but it's, certainly he came to the Seahawks as a free agent, you know, a street free agent, basically.
Completely took DK out of this game and made him not a factor. He talked a lot. They didn't get any penalties on DK, which I will say, good on them. Good on him for not. But Josh Jobe played a phenomenal game of football. When you say that the Steelers defense might be terrible, this is not a discredit to the Seahawks defense, who I think are good. I think the Steelers offense might be terrible.
Could be both.
Could be both. But like, if there's one part of the Steelers where I'm like, that is the part that's actually really bad. I mean, like, Rodgers took a lot of hits in this game. Took 3 sacks for 20 yards overall. He was hit a lot.
Also the play where he was like convinced, and I thought so too in real time, he was going to run for the first down, and then just two Seahawks enveloped him at the same time. It did not seem like the kind of play I would want to be taking as a person in my 40s. So I don't know if it's what Aaron Rodgers wants.
You don't want to be hit by Leonard Williams. I promise.
No situation do I want that.
I left that game thinking to myself, Aaron Rodgers isn't going to finish this season with the Steelers, which is like maybe not that bold of a perspective because he's 41 years old. So like, yes, but I just don't know how he makes it through a full season. He wasn't that good even when he was throwing the ball. I mean, it was kind of incredible to hear the glaze that they had for Arthur Smith and Aaron Rodgers. There was a situation, and I want to say this was the fourth quarter, where they were like, that is just the look of a quarterback and offensive coordinator who are just dialed in together. And he's like 13 of 24 for like 127 yards. And I was like, are we watching the same game right now? They have Aaron Rodgers in hell, the Seahawks defense. Like, Mike McDonald is hounding Aaron Rodgers all throughout the field. Josh Jobe is harassing DK Metcalf. It was a great game by the Seahawks defense. I mean, again, it kind of was the same with the Jets game too, right? Where the Seahawks, in the beginning, they came out blitzkrieg, but I think the Seahawks massively outplayed them yardage wise in that one and still had to like fight to make it close.
I can't remember. There were so many weird plays in that Jets game.
15 carries for 10 yards for Zach Charbonnet. So that is not going to be as bad as it was. That's the thing where I'm like,
neither team gained any yards in the Jets game. Seahawks had 259 on offense. Okay, the Jets had 258.
They're going to run the ball better than they ran the ball. Sharp is going to run the ball better than he ran the ball.
The reason the score was as high as it was in that one was because there was the 290-yard-plus return touchdowns. The Jets on a kickoff, the Seahawks, of course, from Leonard Williams. So
there was a play also where they said that Charles Cross was down, and I will tell you the amount that I gasped, the breath that was held. It ended up being Jalen Sindel, I believe. But who obviously seems like it's not a serious injury at all. But
yeah, no, they... Mike McDonald said after the game that they came out of it clean. That was just a cramping issue for Jalen Sindel.
Yeah, no, I mean, PFF, Ken Walker, Sam Darnold, Cooper Kupp, JSN, Charles Cross, Abe Lucas. It's like, that's your team right there. So, that's,
I mean, to go back to your DK and John Scheider point, like, Cooper Kupp thoroughly outplayed DK Metcalf. The other piece of this is,
it's one game. Like, I don't want to say that
Cooper Kupp
is DK better Metcalf than DK Metcalf right now.
Certainly. But DK Metcalf was a huge factor in week one. In long-term, totally different situation. But the other piece of this is, look, when the Seahawks traded away Geno Smith, you'll recall we recorded on a Friday night. I was in Boston at my hotel at the Sloan Conference. And one of the biggest fear we had was, are the Seahawks going to sign Aaron Rodgers as a free agent? It became pretty clear pretty quickly that it was Sam Darnold was their guy. But there's a world where these quarterbacks are on opposite sidelines. And boy, would I feel a lot worse about the Seattle Seahawks if that were the case for so many reasons.
I think another factor in this, just in the same way that they just undid the national championship last night, we won. but when you actually have to throw the ball, J.J. McCarthy, it's not quite the same. Are you aware that this was a rematch of quarterbacks from the national championship?
I am aware. I don't know if it was the great triumph for Michael Penix Jr. that you're making it out to be.
Hey, he won. They went into their house. The idea that Kevin O'Connell's offense can make
in a broadcast situation, like J.J. McCarthy was asked about, you beat him in the national championship game. And I'm like, I don't know. There was a lot of other NFL talent on that Michigan squad that I think may have had a few things. I noticed a lot of Michigan running backs.
AJ Porter beat him. That's who.
Exactly. I noticed a lot of Michigan running backs running for long touchdowns early in the game. I don't remember J.J. McCarthy running for like 60-yard touchdown. I don't know. Who can say?
Hey, his most valuable asset yesterday was as a runner. it wasn't Aaron Jones's. 11 of 21, two picks, a 6.2 QBR for J.J. McCarthy. So this idea that you could take any quarterback and put them into the Kevin O'Connell system and have them be good.
With Justin Jefferson.
Well, Justin Jefferson was there.
I'm just saying that it's not just Kevin O'Connell that people are talking about. I think Justin Jefferson deserves a lot of the credit.
Sure, yes.
So, but yes, to your point, I think Sam Darnold is underrated.
Sam Darnold is moving toward appropriately rated. That is what I'll say. He's on his way. It took Geno. I mean, like, look, the arc of Geno Smith's career was underrated for a long time. Inched to appropriately rated. Somehow became massively overrated. And now
we'll see. He's fifth in our EPA plus CPOE composite right now. Darnold is 17th, so it's early. But I think the way that you become overrated
is everybody saying that you're underrated.
It is a classic Bill Simmons thing. The Joe Dumars so underrated, he's overrated. Well, Geno might have a terrific season. We'll see what happens tonight against the Chargers. Again, I'm very curious to
even then though we weren't thinking about Geno Smith in this game. I guess I agree with that. We weren't thinking about Geno Smith. And like, honestly, the mistakes that Darnold made were mistakes that Geno was making last year. Like, there was kind of a similar type of game where, for the most part, he was playing well and made a couple of mistakes. And that was kind of Geno's problem throughout the season. So,
agreed.
I left that game thinking to myself, and again, on a positive note for the Seahawks, have you seen the schedule? Because I'll give you the Falcons, but I'm like, which teams have seemed better than we thought they would be going into the season?
I think the Arizona Cardinals perhaps have been better than we thought they'd be. They haven't played anyone yet, to your point, but they were very impressive before the late stages against the Panthers.
Not counting a division game quite as much because, like, you play those.
Yeah.
But, I mean, everybody's going to play everybody. They played the Saints and the Panthers, and they beat the Saints by 7. Like, what? They beat the Saints by 7 and the Panthers by 5. And you brought up the Cardinals?
Well, the score at that point, at one point in that game, was much more lopsided than the final score, which did involve a touchdown in the final 2 minutes by the Panthers. And
I mean, they could have won the game.
They could have. They also trailed 27-3 with 2 minutes and six until scoring a touchdown with 2 minutes left in the third quarter.
I mean, it really is like, the Seahawks are going to win a lot of games.
A lot of games.
I mean, they're going to win a lot of games, even just because of the schedule. They're going to win a lot of games. But
yesterday was a trending towards the over kind of day.
If this is, I guess the Colts are another team you could look at and be like, the Colts are better.
Yes, without question.
But I'm going to give the Colts on December 14th a we'll see. How about that?
But at Washington looked like one of the hardest games you were going to play all season. Doesn't anymore. We'll see. It's 2 weeks. Maybe, you know, maybe Micah Parsons is just that good. There's a long ways to go.
I don't know. I'm feeling very good coming out of this one, which it feels good to feel good. And it could have been very bleak this morning. I mean, especially when
0-2 and everyone else in the division was 2-0. Yes.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, I think their division odds would have been right now. I'm sure everybody's division odds are, I would probably put them all about the same. I would guess that the Rams probably have the best division odds because they're not, they don't have an injured quarterback and they're not the Cardinals and they're a game up on the Seahawks. But like, it was a weirdly huge win for week two of the NFL season, but that was with Spoon being out. And again, some of the players that stepped up, like Darion Kendrick, was the PFF defensively.
Had an interception in the end zone.
Like Ernest Jones wasn't even the top. Leonard Williams just supplant him, number one, right? Big Cat, whether it's stats or not that show up, he's going to be there. Byron Murphy played one of his best games. Tyrese Knight, Boye Mafi, Derek Hall, Darion Kendrick, Jaren Reed. Drake Thomas, too. Kind of like Drake Thomas. I was wondering about Reek, if there's something about Reek having been around, which a lot of the players were around pre-Mike McDonald, but some of the like younger guys who have been stepping up, like your Josh Jobs and even Kendrick, have been people post-Mike McDonald. And I do wonder if there's a little bit of a, I don't want to say buy-in, but just having one message once they've gotten to the team.
Possibly. I mean, Josh Jobe obviously heard other messages because he was with the Philadelphia Eagles before joining the Seahawks. But yeah, I do think that there is an element of getting your guys and fitting them into your system in a different way than taking some of Pete Carroll's guys. Although, you know, it seems to be working with just fine with Leonard Williams and Jaren Reed.
We'll see what happens with Reek. It's
and,
a long
and Julian
season.
Love should note him as well, obviously. It is a long season.
And basically, I'm like, whatever the dialogue is in week two can be drastically different by week 15, by week 16. You know, it takes one or two. I mean, Ken Walker, right? Like, it was such a terrible game that he played in week one. He was probably worst by PFF by basically every metric. And then week two, he's great. Abe Lucas, week two, he's great. I think it was a little bit of like things settled down. Week one is always a little crazy of a week. And I think we're settling into what the Seahawks team will look like a little bit more. So it was a big sigh of relief is what I'll say. It was joy and a sigh of relief for the Seahawks. And then just knowing that the Saints are coming on the other side.
Well, we'll see how a better performance certainly by Spencer Rattler yesterday. So we'll see what sort of Saints we get. But we're going to preview that again on the weekly pod. We'll mostly talk Mariners there. We do have to toast Cal Raleigh, home run number 54, tying Mickey Mantle for the most home runs ever by a switch hitter on Sunday as the Mariners extend their winning streak. So they have done basically all of this since the two games in Atlanta at home. Now comes the real test on the road. But again, we will get into that more on the weekly pod. The other game on Sunday that we wanted to touch on, well, it was fresh, and before they move on to game two of the series on Tuesday night and in a must-win game for the Storm, a rough opening to the playoffs for Seattle at Las Vegas. We didn't know this matchup when we recorded last week. There was still three teams the Storm could have potentially faced in the first round. Minnesota wins the final game of the regular season, beats the Golden State Valkyries, drops the Valkyries down to eighth, avoids the Storm in the first round of the playoffs after the Storm had beaten them twice, including at the Target Center. And then after Vegas won their season finale to go to 16 consecutive wins, that sets up this 2-7 matchup between these two teams who faced in the playoffs last year, who faced in the playoffs in 2022, who faced in the playoffs in 2020, but with a very different look this time around with Joel Lloyd on the other side. And a lot of things happened in this game, almost none of them good for the Storm. But one of the interesting things, it was a close game early on. Jewel Loyd comes off in off the bench, almost immediately scores 7 points on 3 of 3 shooting, and the Aces open up a lead that they never relinquished in this one, and led by 30 plus at points. Still, even though the Storm managed to get the final deficit down to 25, the worst playoff loss in franchise history. And you talked about John Schneider and how good he had to feel watching yesterday's game. It was the opposite for the Storm, who, you know, they didn't go set out to trade Jewel Loyd. That was a trade request by her, as it was a trade request by DK Metcalf. But they were hoping that they could put together a team that would be just as good without her. And, you know, after it looked that way early in the season, when the Storm took 2 of the first 3 from Vegas and Jewel Loyd was really struggling, she's found her game since she's come off the bench. 14 points and 5 of 9 shooting last night, a plus 30 for the Aces in her 26 minutes of play, as the Storm shoot. They ended up with respectable shooting stats, but were around 30% for the first half, scored just 25 points in the first half before putting up 52 in the second half, and never really threatened after halftime in this game.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Jewel Loyd has to be feeling great. I will say every trade request is a decision, and I do think trade requests don't happen in vacuum, for what it's worth.
Well, I don't think it was because Jewel Loyd felt unvalued by the front office, is what I'm saying here. I don't think it was like the front office is like, Jewel Loyd is bad, therefore, she requested the trade. It was a lot more complex than that.
I think the front office has made some very good decisions. I mean, the decision that they made that ended them with the Sparks pick for next year,
yeah,
like
the,
a great
the
decision.
Three-team trade.
How they've ended up with Dom has been excellent. The Brittany Sykes trade was not one of those. And
it's one of those you probably pretty quickly wanted to mulligan on, especially giving up your own pick instead of the Aces. Because again, when they made this trade early August, the Aces had just lost by 53 points to the Lynx. 53 to drop to 500. It took them until, I think, the final week of the regular season on a 16-game winning streak to catch the Storm in terms of plus minus or point differential over the course of the season. Yep. But the Aces ends up the number 14 pick in next year's draft. The Storm's pick will be, I believe, number 8 or number 9.
I mean, that's a big swing also. We don't know if there is a decision. Like, if they had the choice of either pick, or if there was a demand for the pick that they wanted. It's one of those situations where it's like, if there was a, I don't know if there is a fan graphs for the WNBA. We got to get Bart Torvik on it. But like, the Aces playoff odds would have still been excellent in that situation.
I don't think they were better than the Storms at that point.
I'm telling you that I
casually referred
fundamentals,
to it is giving up the worst of their three picks.
I think the underlying fundamentals
the fundamentals were very bad. The vibes were awful. Everything was trending terribly in Vegas. It looked like they were going to quit on the season.
There was too much talent
on
the Aces team. Yeah, I don't think you were there.
If you were there,
you needed numbers to help uncloud your mind.
But I didn't. Their underlying numbers were worse than their record. They had a -3 point differential. And they didn't have that much talent because Jewel Loyd has not played at an all-star level this season. You know, the team that has 4 all-stars this season is the Storm, not the Aces, who had 2.
Then that's another question you probably have to start asking yourself as well, that if the Storm have 4 all-stars and the Aces have 2, it's
pretty sucks. I mean, first off, not all all-stars are equal. Asia Wilson is worth like maybe 10 all-stars.
I don't know if that's exactly true, but I don't know. It's the 16-game win streak isn't great. I will say the Aces feel very Mariners-y in this situation. And
wow, that is a wild thing to say about someone as a compliment?
Question mark? Well, how about this? The Mariners feel very Aces-y
in
this situation. And that's what I'm saying. If there is a Fangraphs, Fangraphs would have known.
And
the Storm would have looked at
Fangraphs
it and had an
known.
Honest perspective. Don't ever question Fangraphs.
Questioning Fangraphs. I'm questioning your interpretation of a WNBA version.
Well, we don't have one.
Relative
we
to
need
me,
one.
Who is a WNBA?
You're clouded. You are clouded by your own personal perspectives in the same way that you felt like Mike McDonald should have punt or kicked a field goal last week. You're bringing personal perspective into this, and you don't argue with the Fangraphs robots. They are right. And I mean, they know everything.
Okay, Vegas's outlook probably might have been like, I don't know. Again, it was an uncontroversial opinion at the time to call the Storms the worst of those three picks, partially because they were getting Britton Sykes.
Way better for years. 4 years. And they added Jewel Lloyd.
Yeah, but they subtracted Kelsey Plum. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She went to the University of Washington. You may have seen the game where she became the all-time leading scorer in women's basketball history before she was surpassed by Caitlin Clark.
One of five teams to miss the playoffs? Come on. It's Asia Wilson's team.
It's, of course it's Asia Wilson's team, but Asia Wilson was on the team while they lost by 53 to Minnesota. It looked like the kind of game that was going to like cause dramatic changes this offseason.
Are they now the favorites to win the championship, or do you still think it's... Who do you think it is?
Minnesota is still the favorites to win the championship. They have home court
Minnesota.
Throughout.
Wow.
I mean, they won by 29 yesterday.
Okay, fair enough. Wait, who did they beat by 29?
Golden State in their playoff debut.
How are the Liberty? I mean, it's kind of, I don't know. WNBA playoffs are kind of wide open here, I suppose.
Well, ask me when we know what Breanna Stewart's knee injury is. She had to leave that game in overtime. The Liberty have not lost a game all season where Breanna Stewart, Jonquel Jones, and Sabrina Ionescu have all finished the game. Unfortunately, we don't know right now whether there are going to be any more of those games.
So, okay, let's say I won't. We could do the year end, the in memoriam for the Storm season.
This is also relevant because Brittany Sykes yesterday, a rough game for her against the Aces. 0-3 from the field, 5 turnovers, 5 personal fouls in 16 minutes. Storm minus 17 in those minutes. She had the worst game score by John Hollinger's game score in a playoff game in WNBA history.
That's not great.
No, that's definitely not ideal.
What is going on with Ezzie? Like, she should be in her prime.
I think that Ezzie year-round play in the EuroLeague, in the WNBA, and for the Australian national team has caught up with her. I think she badly needs a break from that is the clearest explanation for me. But yes, she should be in her prime.
Do you think there's any chance in this series? So they come back to Seattle for game 2.
Yes, which is a change from years past where the series were road, home.
Yeah, no, it was a bonkers thing to do.
Truly.
To give the deciding game to the
like,
to the road team.
I'm going to potentially write about this perhaps by the time this podcast is out. Becky Hammon was like, you know, tough shit, win more in the regular season. But it's like, but this system isn't that good for you either, because if you accidentally lose one game, you're stuck playing the deciding game on the road.
No, it benefits the road team.
For anyone.
Yeah, no, I don't buy that tough shit. It's, we're trying to help you here, Becky.
She did not actually say tough shit, to be clear. I mean, it's better for them from a travel standpoint. No. And if you sweep the series, as the Aces did last year, and
forget those guys.
You know, all that was great. Is the Aces have done in all of their first round series under the former format, they swept them all. And if you sweep it, it's awesome. You don't have to get on a plane at all, you know, and then you move on to the next round. But if you lose, all of a sudden you're put in this very uncomfortable position. Granted, no team has lost a series in that position yet. But, you know, I do think it's a more equitable system for all sides, not just for the team that gets you know, I haven't looked at the history of WNBA teams that lose this badly in game one, what happens in game two. I will say the Aces are running incredibly hot from 3-point range right now. This is not a team that is necessarily an elite shooting team over the course of the season. In their final game of the regular season, they've
won 17 games in a row. Like,
well, but the point is, in those games, they've shot dramatically differently than they did before. Is this tends to happen?
I'm just so, like, at this point, if you're like, but the 18th game, that's when they go off. I mean, it's a perspective.
Well, it's not like they have zero games where they've shot poorly in this year. They shot 32% from three in that 14-14 stretch they had to start the season before the winning streak. During the winning streak, in the regular season, they shot 40% from three. Yesterday, they shot 48%. It was their third consecutive game shooting 48% or better from three. But in the game before that against Chicago, they shot 29%. So it's not like they can't have an off night. And then on the flip side of it, The Storm did make some threes in the second half, but opponents have been running, as you might imagine, particularly cool against the Aces from three-point range. And these are things that are not... The fact that you've done it 17 times in a row, or whatever it is, the coin doesn't remember that. So, and I think the other thing that will greatly help the Storm in Game 2 is the experience that Dominique Malunga got in Game 1 of this series. She is the future. She is the timeline. And the adjustment to the playoffs was rough right away. She was 0-1-for-8 from the field in the first half. Second half, first time in her career she has ever made 2 3-pointers in a game and finishes with a double-double. So that was the bright spot.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, like, perspective of it. Can't keep going on forever. I would not bet a lot of money on the Storm in this one.
I mean,
or the Aces coin. They're also just a better team even without the 3-point shooting. That's the other piece, is they're winning some of these games without hot 3-point shooting.
Of course. Let me see what is the line for game two here. Aces are 5.5-point favorites in that one.
I mean, can the Storm win? Of course they can, but like, it's going to take a pretty radically different performance. And I think the Aces are going to be pretty incentivized to win this game and not have to play a game three.
Without question. So, especially looking on the other side, Atlanta playing an injury-plagued Indiana team. They're not as large favorites. They're only 4.5-point favorites. But the Dream with a chance to close that out on the other side of the series. But by the time we next record, we will either presumably...
It's not that many. I guess it's like a few. 14 of 29. Jackie Young. I mean, Kirsten Bell shot 1 of 5. It was the 3 for 6 from Jewel Lloyd and the 3 for 6 from Dane Evans. But like, I guess they shot better. They just don't shoot as many threes as they do in the NBA.
They really don't.
The Storm don't shoot enough threes in general, in my opinion.
I agree.
The changes are coming.
Last night made it more difficult to envision them staying the course. So
I'm fascinated. Like, I'm looking forward to the season being over and to hearing your perspective of what the off season looks like for the Storm, because I looked at this one, and by the time I was like doing something else, and by the time I was ready to turn it on, they were down by 20 points, and I was like, yeah, I'm good. I'm fine on that one. I was like, I'm going to keep watching Michael Penix here, but it's not a good place to be in the playoffs right now. But
well, stay tuned for my feature on Neka Gumake and Skylar Diggins and how the longtime friends finally teamed up in Seattle.
What? You actually have that coming?
Oh, yeah.
Why now? They signed together like 2 years ago. You waited till the playoffs. Wait, does this have to be cut out? You waited until the playoffs after they're bad to have that feature? Not bad, but like when they're about to get bounced from the playoffs. Did no one see this coming? Somebody should have consulted me.
I mean, I thought it was very likely they would be down 1-0 in the series. I did not think that they were going to perform as poorly as they did.
They were this pitifully down?
I mean, they had, as I pointed out on Blue Sky last night, like, whatever your level of frustration about the Storm second half, and a lot of frustration is understandable, it was mostly them blowing leads or losing games in the clutch, not them getting blown out. They only lost one game by 10 plus after July 22nd.
You're so much like me with the Huskies last year. I mean, someday the Storm are going to actually be good. And then like maybe these players will be on the team and you'll take your Jed victory lap, where all of a sudden we're so scared about the Florida job. but like, we were kind of scared about it last year, even when the team was bad. But like, we're like 5-7.
Bad.
We're like,
I don't think the team was bad.
They were under 500. How about that? When the team was under 500, it probably would have been nice if they would have fired Billy Napier last year. But like,
what if
they maybe waited 1 year too long? I do wonder if Kalen DeBoer's transition to the SEC not going as expected, if Jed might have noticed that happening, and then the coach and the team down south just being good with a lot of money and infrastructure.
Hey, hasn't Dante Moore guy played?
Come on, he played fine.
You're gonna come on to me?
It's like playing. They played the Saints and the Panthers. How about that one?
I suppose. They beat the Saints in PM. Wow, Jaden Maiava is number one in QBR in the country. I did not realize that. Dante Moore is 10th.
34-14 over Northwestern. I'm not really too hot to trot about it.
I think they're going to be fine.
Their defense is good.
I think their offense
is good. They play Penn State the same weekend that we play Ohio State.
They do.
Call me after that. We will see. We'll see for both teams.
I'm not saying they're going to win the game. I'm just saying they're number one in offensive efficiency and number one in overall FBI efficiency. I think Oregon's pretty good.
Fair enough. But I do wonder if Jed has seen that and seen that thing. Anyway, I'm like, they outgained everybody. Nobody was watching. They outgained Rutgers. They outgained Iowa. That's you with the storm. You're just like,
Mike,
the team is
not
nobody
exactly
realizes
the
it. Their 25-point loss is actually good.
That the 25-point loss is actually good. It's that it was not as predictable as people think it was before the fact, which is evidenced by the fact that they were not 25-point underdogs in the game.
Sure, fair. If they were 25-point underdogs, I probably would have bet on the Aces or on the Storm.
I bet you would have.
I think most people would have, because there's probably never been a 25-point underdog in WNBA playoff history.
I am confident there has not. I don't think there even has been an NFL playoff history, even the Beastquake.
That wasn't a 25-point game. Did they win that game by that much?
No. The point was that they would have been the 25-point underdogs.
Oh, yes. Okay, fair enough. So we'll see. But I appreciate your constant positivity about the Storm and how them losing badly was actually...
go so far as to say that it's positivity. I'm just saying that was not reflective of what they have been this season, even though what they have been has been disappointing. Okay? Like, there's levels to this.
Okay. I like that I have a thing for you that I get to do the Kevin Pelton. Okay. And you get to be the angry one.
I would say it feels a lot like 2007 for the Storm right now, which is... I mean, it feels different in many ways, but 2007, after that season, we've talked about this before, new head coach, traded away, you know, all of the starters except Lauren Jackson and Sue Bird, and brought in, you know, I don't think they're going to bring in Cheryl Swoops and Yolanda Griffith and Swin Cash this time around, but I think that it has some feel of that, where it was just like this era, as good as it has been, has run its course. And I do think we've reached that point with the Storm. Okay? Can you accept that?
Also have Lauren Jackson and Sue Bird.
You're right.
Maybe Dom is that good, though. I don't know. We'll see. Dom might be as good as Lauren.
Again, they do have a lottery pick in this year's draft. That's the number one thing to take away. It's from them making the playoffs. The most important thing is not them making the playoffs. It is the Los Angeles Sparks missing the playoffs. And we did not talk about this because we reported before this happened last week. The Aces, they're beating the Sparks in the season finale, assured that the Sparks will go in is the number three team in the lottery.
I mean, that's
the third
best
odds of the number one pick.
That's a terrible trade that the Sparks made.
No, that was the trade to get Rekia Jackson. So they got the number four pick out of it.
Okay, fair enough.
But
they got
people,
the number four. And Rekia Jackson's good.
You throughout last season were arguing it was a terrible trade for the Storm because they had done that to clear the room to sign Neko Ogumeke and Skylar Diggins and had not, you know, been a championship contender. And Angel Reese was looking like a star player. Angel Reese is still an extraordinarily talented player. Some complications to the end of her season with the Chicago Sky, let's say, in terms of the poorly received interview she did where she essentially asked for more help around her in a way that perhaps slighted her teammates and that did not take the court for the Chicago Sky again the remainder of the season. So that's a situation to monitor in the offseason. But anyways, the Storm got that cap space, but they also got LA's 2026 pick. And they correctly guessed that LA was not going to be able to get back into the playoffs within a year.
They got a little lucky. They got a little lucky there. You can't argue that they didn't.
How so?
It was a worthwhile risk.
They also helped facilitate LA getting better this year in exchange for the number two pick.
Yes.
And still, I mean, your concern was what? They were going to get Paige Beckers? Like, that didn't work for the Dallas Wings.
I mean, the Valkyries made the playoffs this year. Like, I don't... There's a lot of worlds where the Sparks make the playoffs this season.
Probably, but the Sparks also, and I was correct about this, were not as good as people thought they were coming into the season. So,
women's basketball fan graphs would have known. No, I think the front office has handled things pretty well. The only thing they did wrong was the Brittany Sykes trade, basically. It's,
if you could take a mulligan on that, you would feel a lot better on going into the offseason with three first-round picks.
If you have that one more pick, you can kind of turn over the roster a lot more, and you get more flexibility heading into the draft as well.
Yes.
But they might win the lottery. We don't know.
Yeah.
So there are, I think in general, it's not like the franchise is in a bad place right now, but it's pretty clear that they need to, the idea of just being like, this is our core. And you're like, we have to build around this core that is getting beat by 25 points in a playoff game. And you're just like, why?
I agree that it is less tenable than it was Sunday afternoon. And I don't know how tenable it was then.
They weren't going to win a champion. This core is not going to win a championship unless something drastically different happens.
I mean, unless Dong becomes a superstar overnight. I agree with all of that. The question is, how much are the Storm concerned about not being bad?
If Dong becomes a superstar overnight, are NECA and Skylar that excited, like, to just kind of take the back seat? And it has to be Dom's team at that point.
I think so.
You think they're going to be like, it's your team now? That just doesn't happen. There is an attrition when all of a sudden somebody moves from being a rookie to being the central focus point of an offense and a defense.
If only we had an example of one of the most respected power forwards in league history taking a backseat to a younger player and having a second era of championship success. I can't think of what that
you're
might
talking
have
about
been.
David Robinson?
Well, I was talking about Tim Duncan, but...
Tim Duncan, David Robinson is what you're talking about?
Yes, I'm talking about Duncan with Kawhi Leonard in that era.
I am telling you, I think that Tim Duncan is built different and David Robinson is built
different. I think Neko Gubake is built pretty differently.
Okay.
Although she did have a moment in this game where she got a technical foul. Jewel Lloyd, she was called for an offensive foul, posting up Jewel Lloyd, where Jewel Lloyd tried to pull the chair on her and then dropped the ball and tossed it backwards, and it hit Lloyd in the back, and the Aces, particularly Chelsea Gray, also, like Jewel Lloyd, Neko Gumeke's former teammate, they played together for a long time, won a championship in L.A., took exception to that. Neko said after the game that she didn't know that Jewel was there, and then the Storm, oddly enough, challenged the play and won the challenge. It was called a foul on Jewel Lloyd. So, but Neko did acknowledge that she needed to be more cognizant and that she was frustrated in the moment, so. Anyways.
Fair enough.
Well, we can talk about all this at season's end.
On Tuesday night. We can talk about this at season end on Wednesday. At least the Seahawks are in win a game and the Mariners are in first place. And that's all.
It was ultimately
right
a
now.
Very happy sports weekend in Seattle. As long as you're not a Cougars fan. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.